I'm still amazed as a professor, lived, born and raised in America and taught in American universities all my life, when I explain that in France, for example, when you graduate high school and you take a job, the law requires the employer to give you 5 weeks of paid vacation from day one. Doesn't depend on who your union is or isn't. Doesn't depend on who your employer is. It's the law. Socialists got that law. Higher education in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, is effectively free. No tuition, no fees. Why? Because the socialist movement fought for those things. Americans can't even imagine it. And that's partly because the socialism has been kept at bay by defining politics as if it went no further than what you saw last night.
And certainly you've made the point that both of the political parties that dominate the scene in this country, the Republicans and Democrats, they're both capitalist parties. And both of the candidates for president, whether it be Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, are also have that philosophy, that political economic philosophy. But in the context of the growing fear of fascism in this country, do you not think there is a qualitative political difference there between, well, between Trump and Harris? I know a good many people on the left do. They argue there is a great deal of a difference. They say, well, you know, Trump, along with the fascistic nationalism of that Project 2025 report that you referenced, would represent, if he were elected, a further big, dangerous step towards fascism in America, or at the very least, the coming of an authoritarian president if Trump is elected. So what are your thoughts on that, given that, nevertheless, both candidates are themselves capitalists from capitalist parties?
Well, my sense is the following. Sometimes the little difference is the only difference you can grab hold of, and I think we're in that situation. Mr. Trump seems to be very comfortable imagining a fascistic turn in the United States, especially one with him at the helm. He idolizes leaders around the world who have also taken steps in that direction. He clearly is a Republican. He clearly favors capital over labor. He doesn't understand most of the issues that are involved there other than from an employer point of view. So, yeah, I think he would be the easiest, quickest convert to a fascistic solution as the problems arise for which this capitalism in America is so poorly prepared to deal. I think the difference is that Kamala Harris would take a little longer. She might be a bit more hesitant to make those moves. If you're asking me, is she capable of ending up in a similar place? I don't have the slightest doubt that she is. She has been part of this system all of her life, or certainly all of her adult life, and there's no reason to doubt that she would. But I think that the real question is, and that has always been the case, will the mass of the people allow either of them, and I mean either of them, to go in that direction? The union movement isn't going to do that. Black Lives Matter isn't going to do that. The Palestinian people concerned about the horror there, are those movements going to grow? Are those movements going to converge and become a power together? Let me give an example right now, because people wonder, oh, that's a pie in the sky. The last national election in France, which was literally a few weeks ago, saw a remarkable development in a country not that different from the United States. 4 different left-wing political parties. The French Socialist Party, the French Communist Party, the French Green Party, and the largest of them, a party known as France Unbowed, led by a Marxist, former communist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They ran for office. They're now the number one political party in France. They have the largest number of seats. Mr. Macron, who we hear is the leader of France, came in 3rd out of 3 major parties. He's finished politically, and the left, when it unified, is now in a dominant powerful position in the French government. And this is not pie in the sky and not fanciful notion. If the left in the United States can overcome its narrowness, its division into too many little groups, and it can become focused, it will be the determinant of whether any fascism takes root again in the United States, or whether instead capitalism will have to find an alternative way to solve its problems rather than to degenerate into a fascism the way it did when it couldn't solve its problems in Italy or France or Spain or Japan in the last century that we saw with such devastating effects. That's the issue. That's why what happens on the left in the United States is a crucial, and the understanding that capitalism is the problem is why, not only why I wrote the book, but why I thought it could contribute to an overcoming of what's holding back the best bet we have to prevent fascism.
Richard Wolff, it's been terrific having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to go, can you tell people how can they get your book, Understanding Capitalism, and how can people keep up with your work?
Well, the answer to both questions is the same, and it's very simple. Just go to our website, and it's called democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracy at work, no punctuation, democracyatwork.info. There you will find out about the new book, Understanding Capitalism, and everything else we do to make these arguments and to disseminate them globally.
Well, my goodness. Richard Wolff, again, we thank you so much. It's always the pleasure to have you here on Law and Disorder. Thank you for being with us again and for so clearly and passionately explaining what is at stake.
Okay, and my hat's off to both of you and all of you for maintaining this program. It's one of the ways to get these issues put on the table, which is more necessary now than ever before.
Richard Wolff, a million thanks for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics, perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed programmatically, and not animated by any kind of cadre of capable administrators. It was instead full of his statements and actions that many critics deemed to be racist, sexist, and xenophobic. He lost the election in 2020, although he did receive 74 million votes. And as he runs for the presidency again, this time he is talking, well, rather openly about wanting dictatorial authority, if indeed he is elected. And this time, if he does win, he now also has the aid of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced that 900-page Project 2025 document on how to radically change our country so as to make it far, far more conservative, provide far fewer rights to the American people, and allow any president so inclined to run the country as a virtual dictator. He has the financial support of a number of billionaires. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Donald Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed him above the law, allowing the president to do almost anything he or she might want to do as long as it's deemed to be an official presidential act. And so today's program is the lead-off to a series of shows about fascism. Experts will discuss what it is, how it can be resisted, and how one organizes to make that resistance meaningful. We're going to start this series with today's guest, who is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a wise and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a moral and political philosopher as well. He has written a book entitled American Fascism. So we will ask Chris how he defines American fascism and, again, how we can fight against it to be sure that we can save our troubled democracy. Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you covered the Christian right for 2 years and wrote a book titled American Fascists. Who were these American fascists that you were identifying? Did Christian nationalism play a part in this? Talk to us about that.
So let me go back a little bit. I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a professor, but a seminary graduate. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, so I am steeped in the Bible. I have biblical literacy. I understand the church, how it works. And in my last year at Harvard, I had a tutorial. This was with an emeritus professor named James Luther Adams. It was kind of built on the British system where he would take two final year students and work with them. And he had been in Germany at the University of Heidelberg. He was bilingual in German in 1935 and 1936. He'd actually been in the lecture hall with Heidegger giving the Nazi salute. So don't let anyone ever tell you that Heidegger didn't begin his lectures that way. And he dropped out of the university and joined the underground confessing church. That was the church run by Niemöller, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer. They called out the traditional mainstream church for not denouncing fascism, but they also watched the rise of the so-called German Christian church, which was pro-Nazi. And Adams, so this was in the early 1980s, saw in the rise of the Christian right, Christian nationalism in the United States, echoes of that so-called German Christian church, which was fascist, which had the Nazi flag on one side of the altar and the German flag on the other, or the Christian flag or whatever it was. So he was the first person to call these people Christian fascists. He was 80 years old when I had him, and I remember him saying to me that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. These are heretics. These are people who have sacralized the worst elements of white supremacy, American capitalism, American imperialism, by distorting the biblical message. That was the book now is, I think, 18 years old or something. It was a very unpopular position to take at the time because the liberal church was attempting to engage in dialogue with these figures like Falwell and others. But of course, there was no real interest. In fact, one of my professors at Harvard invited Falwell to come speak, and I worked with the GBLT community at Harvard to shut down all the streets around the Kennedy School where he spoke. Well, it was all Falwell did was, in essence, flip the middle finger at Harvard while his cameras rolled. It was a great fundraising technique. He had no interest in dialogue at all. And this movement is what was one that was nascent when I was a divinity student. I was overseas for 20 years, but I came back and it had exploded to the point where, of course, in many of the senior positions in the Trump administration were filled by these figures, Mike Pence, Barr, Betsy DuBois, and others. And it functions as any totalitarian movement functions. It engages in magical thinking. This Hannah Arendt argues that this is a fundamental element of all totalitarianism. It preys on the despair and alienation and even rage of its adherents. It's cultish, and Trump functions far more as a cult figure for his followers than as a political figure. It has all of the attributes. And when you look at studies of fascism, like Robert Paxton's book, Anatomy of Fascism, or Fritz Stern's The Politics of Cultural Despair, or other books like that, they always talk about how fascism, when it rises, uses the familiar comforting symbols that are indigenous to the culture. So German fascism, which was grounded in Teutonic myths, didn't look like Italian fascism, which harkened back to ancient Rome. And as Paxton said, when fascism comes to America, it will be with mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and the Christian cross and the flag. And that's precisely what's happened. So that's what I spent 2 years on the book. I spent a lot of time with these people, which is the only way to fully understand them. But what I found fascinating, I was always upfront about who I was and where I came from. As soon as they knew that I had, or I was biblically literate, they never wanted to talk about the Bible with me. And the reason is because they don't know the Bible. They know those sections of it that they've been fed to buttress their ideology, but they don't really know it at all. And it is, all of these megachurches, pastors who are often, when they're successful, millionaires and private jets and everything else, are cult figures. They can't be challenged. They are in direct contact with God. And Trump just became that figure writ large, in fact, to the detriment of many of the mega pastors, because they transferred that kind of localized authority or complete authority over their adherents to Trump. I saw it coming. I understood the danger of it, and I understood, I didn't predict a Trump, but I certainly predicted or saw the rise of a demagogue out of this movement, and that's precisely what happened.
And your book is now 18 years old, as you mentioned, but it seems to me, and so I want to ask you, what makes it so relevant today? Is it the Trump phenomena, the fact that now there is that phenomena, the Make America Great slogans and the Trumpism, cultism that goes with it? Talk to us about the relevancy of it today, more so. Should we be more alarmed today even than you were 18 years ago?
Well, definitely we should be more alarmed, because these people are on the cusp of taking power. And a second Trump administration won't look like a first. It'll be far more vindictive. And Trump was just mercurial and impulsive and disorganized. That isn't going to happen this time. Well, I think it's an important book because it explains the pathology of the Christian right, why they do what they do. I mean, just a small example, I went to a Right to Life weekend in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And again, I know as a reporter for many years for the New York Times, that you can't understand these movements unless you spend hours and hours on the ground talking to people who are involved in them. So this Right to Life weekend, there are about 400 women. They asked at the beginning for all the post-abortive sisters to stand, and almost the whole room stood. And when I started doing interviews, it wasn't that they had had an abortion. Many of them had multiple abortions. And they would take these people off, they take them off for weekends, and they give them plastic dolls and tell them these are the children they've murdered, and they have to dress the doll and bathe the doll and name the doll, and at the end of the weekend beg for forgiveness and vow to fight the culture of death, which is us. You know, there was that insight into the manipulation of guilt and despair to essentially recruit people to fight against the secular humanist society. I mean, that's a window into the so-called Right to Life movement that you don't get if you don't spend time with them. I took a seminar in Missouri, a creationist seminar. So they were teaching teachers in Christian schools, quote unquote Christian schools, how to teach about creationism, about the creation, which is supposedly literally true from Genesis. Well, the problem is that according to the Bible, the sun or light is not created until the fourth day. So do you spend the first 4 days in complete and utter darkness? And the teacher said, well, tell the students that God created a temporary light. Well, that's not in the Bible, but it is in those kinds of details that you see the irrationality. The rapture is not in the Bible. It's not there. When you put that ideology under a microscope, when you look at it with those kind of details, you see how frighteningly, you know, irrational it is, and how it is really about the perpetuation of magical thinking. And that I did walk away. The first chapter of the book is despair, because these people have been through it. They've lost their jobs. They've been evicted. I didn't put it in the book because it was anecdotal, but almost every woman that I interviewed had suffered sexual or domestic abuse, struggles with addictions, opioid addictions, alcoholism, gambling. And so that secular world almost destroyed them. And that engenders the rage against that world. So I was in an end times gathering with Tim LaHaye, who wrote this very popular series. And by the way, just on the New York Times bestseller list, they exclude quote-unquote Christian books because it's a genre. But if they didn't, those would be the top 10 best-selling books. Or they would all come out of Christian nationalism. And it was this blood-curdling, you know, very graphic description of people's heads exploding and blood gushing out of their eyes kind of stuff at the end time. So when the Armageddon comes and the Antichrist returns and et cetera, and, you know, which all prefaces supposedly the return of the Messiah. And I realized that these people really hate the world outside the walls of that church and want to see it destroyed. There's an apocalyptic vision there that is very, very frightening. When you look closely at their lives and what has happened to them, you understand why they feel that way. But it's very, at the conclusion of the book is that either these people who have been marginalized and pushed aside, especially through deindustrialization, either they are reintegrated into American society or we are finished. That's how I conclude the book, which I still feel is true.
And you've made the point that there's been an advance of Christian nationalism since you wrote the book. A further advance, a further entrenchment of it in so many of the laws in this country, including in what's going on in the schools. Let's talk then and turn our conversation then to the question of, well, what does one do? How does one fight that growing fascistic nature of the American body politic? You wrote in your book that that what we lack at that time, what you called, I think, a countervailing force. What's an example of that and how could we help create a more effective countervailing force?
We're not going to argue these people out of irrational belief. We're not going to argue them out of creationism or a narrative that is not based on verifiable fact or science. It isn't going to work. The only way is to give them the kind of economic, social stability that has plunged them into this kind of despair and seen them grasp at this kind of magical thinking in order to endure. And this is the common denominator for all forms of totalitarianism, including traditional fascism. It is built, I mean, this is the whole thesis of Fritz Stern. I knew Fritz Stern. He left Nazi Germany when he was 18 as a refugee, taught at Columbia. But this is the whole thesis of his book, The Politics of Cultural Despair. And also Hannah Arendt picks up on that theme. So we have to address the social pathologies that have pushed people into the arms of these very frightening figures. And we're not doing that. Okay? The Democratic Party is ignoring it. The mercenary nature of the healthcare system, the skyrocketing utilities, you know, in our towns and cities, which have been sold off to private interests, rising food prices, the wage stagnation, the refusal to raise the minimum wage significantly, the breaking of unions. These are the conditions that create fascist totalitarian movements, and we're ignoring them. In fact, of course, the Democratic Party tends to demonize those figures. Not that they're not potentially frightening, not that the movement is not frightening, it is, but it's not addressed. I mean, if you go back and look at Weimar Germany before the 1929 global crash, the Nazis were polling in the single digits, I don't know, 4% or something. Well, what happened after the 29 crash is that the Weimar government took out all sorts of loans, international loans, to keep the economy afloat, but they sacrificed the working class. They actually suspended employment insurance for millions of Germans. And, of course, what happened is this thrust destitute, desperate Germans into the arms of fascist movements. You had a countervailing communist movement largely in the urban centers, and you had strong unions. It was a different kind of social dynamic, and the Nazis, of course, as soon as they took power, set out to crush that opposition, which they did, unfortunately, successfully. But it's the same dynamic, and we're not addressing the root causes that cause people to embrace these figures and rally around these cult-like politicians like Trump. And honestly, if it wasn't Trump, it would be someone else. You know, I think too often the liberal class or liberals tend to demonize Trump as if Trump is the problem. Trump is the symptom. Trump is not the disease. And we're not addressing the disease. And that's the whole point of my book.
Yes. you're making it clear, I think, that we also then need a new independent movement or independent party, a new party of our own. Talk to us about that if we can't look to the either of the capitalist parties for the relief that is needed if fascism is not to run the day. How do we go about doing that? It's difficult, certainly. Many people have tried this before. What is your own thinking on how we go about creating the kind of countervailing force to those two parties so as to prevent what is happening?
Well, the two parties have conspired ever since Ross Perot to essentially block independent and third-party candidates. They do that primarily through making ballot access almost impossible, and I know because I worked with Ralph Nader. I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter, so I saw what they did. Presidential campaigns cost $1 billion, and you're just denied media access. You're not permitted to participate in the debates. You're shut out. The media is a kind of echo chamber for the system. When they do talk about third-party figures, whether it's Nader, Jill Stein, Cornel West, anyone else, they ridicule them and demon if they get mentioned at all. So that, and Teresa Armato wrote a good book. The name of the book escapes me. She was Ralph's, she's quite a brilliant attorney in her own right, but she ran Ralph's campaign. But she wrote about all of the hurdles and impediments and obstacles that the two parties together put up to block any kind of third-party movement. And that has really hurt us tremendously, and that's by design. I think the other big issue are unions, and this is why you have Shama Sawant, the former socialist city councilwoman in Seattle, trying to build militant movements. I mean, the only power we have comes through organized entities, grassroots entities, but in particular organized labor, because the capacity to strike is the only capacity we have to essentially cripple the system and make the system begin to address our demand. So you have 11% of the workforce in the United States is unionized. I think 6% of that is in the public sector. When the railroad freight workers, when they threatened to strike, Biden invoked the, I think it's called the Railroad Act, I can't remember the exact name, to essentially make the strike illegal, which kind of throws the lie that he's the most pro-union president, you know, going. And so the mechanisms by which we once, including, I think, an independent and a free media, you go back and look at public broadcasting 2, 3, 4 decades ago, you could see figures like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and even Malcolm X. That's all gone because, of course, they've slashed the funding and the corporate donors keep both public radio and public television alive, and they have to cater to their donor class like every other news organization. So there's been, the media is atrophied. You know, the range of acceptable opinion is kind of narrowed from A to B, to steal a line from Dorothy Parker when she talked about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actor. The health of our democracy is dire. The mechanisms by which we could reform it and address injustices have essentially been shut down through corporate power. Sheldon Wolin, I cite him all the time, but he's important. In his book, Democracy Incorporated, elucidates that. He died a few years ago. And I did the last interview with him, which is on YouTube. It's 3 hours long. He taught at Berkeley, taught at Princeton, Cornel West mentor. But we've undergone a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And it's over. They've won. These people have deformed the system to create the most grotesque and pronounced inequality in American history. They have designed a system by which money is funneled upwards, including, of course, slashing tax rates for corporations. I think, a year or two ago, Amazon didn't pay any taxes. I think it actually got money back. And this rapacious billionaire class, so these figures, $180, $200 billion these individuals are worth. So, I mean, you read Aristotle, and he said that when you have that kind of social inequality, your only two options are tyranny or revolution. And we're well on the road to tyranny in the guise of Christian fascism.
And in terms of then what is needed to prevent that, that's the question. And of course, it's no doubt, as you've just described, how difficult that fight back effort would be. Do you take any encouragement at all from the fact that, public opinion polling shows that the younger people in America today prefer, for example, a socialist economy as opposed to a capitalist economy. The changing demographics of the country itself and what sometimes that portends. Do you think that before America would become a fully embedded fascistic country, there is the expectation in your mind, or the hope in your mind, or the possibility at least in your mind, that that could be prevented?
The problem is that we've been disempowered. I mean, that goes all the way back to the McCarthyite smears. Ellen Schrecker wrote two good books on this. And they purged the American system. Cold War liberalism, of course, distorts the very notion of liberalism. We're not organized. I mean, I take hope in the consciousness, especially of the young, who have been, we know, completely abandoned by the system. I mean, they can't find work, meaningful work. They can't afford a house. They've been essentially pushed out of the system. So yes, there is a consciousness, but we have to build the kind of militant organizations that can begin to shut down and cripple the system. And we don't have them. And that's what worries me. So if you look at the 1930s, what happened in the United States economically and what happened in Europe was very similar, but the responses were very different. Why? Because we had powerful militant labor organizations in the U.S., along with an independent press, much of it driven by the Communist Party, which we've written out of U.S. history largely, and it frightened the ruling elites. I mean, Roosevelt, FDR, said his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I've read his private correspondence to his brother, and there's a fascinating letter early on in the 30s where he said, we have to begin to address this, the poverty and the unemployment, otherwise we'll get revolution. That's his word. And of course, the specter of the 1917 revolution in Russia and the rise of the Bolsheviks terrifies the capitalist class. And so that's how, that is the impetus, along with all sorts of, like the GM sit-down strikes and everything else, that pushes Roosevelt to create a government jobs program. 12 million people are employed, public works, the WPA, along with Social Security, along with the 8-hour workday. But it didn't come because of the kindness or goodness of the ruling class. Became because they're frightened, which is always how it works. And we have been effectively disarmed. We've been effectively, are the movements and organizations we had by which we could protect our own rights have essentially been taken from us. And that worries me. So without those countervailing forces, it becomes far easier for fascistic programs and entities, parties to achieve power. So yes, the consciousness is there, but we lack the organizational structures to pit power against power.
So therefore, what should we do? What can we do?
Rebuild them as fast as we can. And yeah, that means stepping outside the system. It means union organizing. It means refusing to participate. I mean, you know, I covered Gaza, you know, for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I cannot vote for anyone who supports genocide. I mean, I've lost friends, others have disappeared. I just came back from the Middle East. I was there all summer. I speak Arabic, but I was doing a refresher course because I'm going to do my next book on Gaza with the cartoonist Joe Sacco. I have just too many Palestinian friends. I can't, you know, in every way. So I think we have to draw red lines that we won't cross. If enough people step outside the system will begin to get worried and the system will begin to respond. But that's what we have to do.
Well, I was thinking of during Vietnam, and what it took was many, many years, of course, of the slow and then sometimes more rapid growth of a massive movement that finally made it basically impossible, along with the victories of the Vietnamese on the battlefield, of course, the Viet Cong on the battlefield, for the United States government to carry on that imperialist war.
People forget. I mean, the civil rights movement, when was the first, I think Rosa Parks was on the bus in, what was it, 1954? It takes, I just spent 14 years fighting for the freedom of Julian Assange, but it took 14 years.
Well, Chris Hedges, then, final thought or two, and then how can people follow your work?
I think we have to regain the kind of militancy. Remember, we are now facing the rise of an extremist, I would call it fascistic, movement that potentially could seize power with a Trump administration. read the Heritage Foundation 2025. They're prepared this time around in a way they weren't during the last Trump administration. Clearly, Trump will come in with a vindictive agenda to dismantle any centers of power that don't pay complete fealty to his personality cult. I think that we have to begin to confront that militancy with a militancy of our own. That essentially means shutting the system down, because that is, we have the numbers. That is what we have the capacity to do. I visited the student encampments opposing the genocide at Columbia and Princeton, and these students are, they understand that this is more than the genocide. This is about creating a kind of global environment where the rule of law no longer matters, where a genocide becomes an acceptable weapon, especially with mass migrations because of the climate crisis and everything else. So we have to begin to see through the propaganda that is spewed out over the airwaves about a system that it no longer represents our interests, but serves the interests of the billionaire class and the military-industrial complex, as Karl Liebknecht, the great German socialist, said about the German military on the eve of World War I. He called them the enemy from within, the enemy within. And I think that kind of consciousness and that kind of organization is where hope lies. And on chrishedges.substack.com, I also have on YouTube a YouTube channel where I now do my show after being pushed out of the real news for my frequent criticisms of Joe Biden and the Biden administration over the genocide in Gaza.
That's what happens when you're honest in America these days. Chris Hedges, I can't thank you enough, really. Thank you so much for your work, your wonderful work, and for taking time to join us here on Law and Disorder.
Not at all. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning Sunday morning, it's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday Sunday morning.
to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
As we take our places, total strangers with familiar faces. I could never forget that look in your eyes, but you've already forgot me once we said our goodbyes. I won't let that be the end. There's something I can still defend. Know it's somewhere deep in your heart. Fire and love, that spark. No, I love you to death. I'll keep fighting till my last breath. You're the woman I love and I simply adore. I long to have you in my arms once more. You know I'll never forget, never forget how you left that night with no regret. The pain from that moment still haunts me today. The specter of love that's gone.
Once more, you know I'll never forget how you left.
want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
Just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling I don't want to know. Sunday morning,
comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Thank you. our places. Total strangers with familiar faces. I could never forget that look in your eyes, but you've already forgot me once we said our goodbyes. I won't let that be the end. It's something I can still defend. Know it's somewhere deep in your heart. Fire and love, that spark can start. You know I love you to death,
love you to death.
I'll keep fighting till my last breath. You're the woman I love and I simply adore. I long to have you in my arms once more. You know I'll never forget,
never forget
how you left that night with no regret. The pain from that moment still haunts me today. The specter of love that's gone.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You want to start it?
Yeah, do it in D.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum. We have several items this week to reflect on what's happening in the news.
Kamala Harris unveiled a new economic plan to provide more opportunities for black men, part of the Democrats' broader effort to secure the black vote. Theodore R. Johnson is an expert on this issue. His new book, If We Are Brave, Essays from Black Americana, tackles race and democracy. And he joins Michelle Martin to take us through those firsthand accounts.
Thanks, Christiane. Theodore Johnson, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You're kind of a a different animal when it comes to, you know, sort of punditry per se. I mean, you know, 20-year Navy veteran, you are a columnist for major news outlets, and you're an author. So it's kind of hard to pigeonhole you, just like it's kind of hard to pigeonhole this book. Like, how do you describe it? What do you think this book does?
The book is an essay collection in sort of the traditional sense of the term for Black writers in particular. I mean, it's probably too much praise, but I think of it in the same vein of writing as like the Harlem Renaissance and the essayists of the civil rights movement that were very rigorous in their journalism, in their research, but had a common touch in how they relayed very complicated and complex issues to a general public. So I sort of think of my career as providing the perfect background or a set of life experiences that allow me to tackle big topics in essay form while also incorporating the very rigorously researched insights that I hope to bring forward in the writing.
I see it as reflections on what it means to be an American. It's reflections on democracy, but from a very distinctly African-American, you know, perspective. Why did you feel we need to have these conversations right now?
Yeah, so most of it is because there seems to be a fight over the identity of this country and the people that belong here. Some folks want to take us back hundreds of years, and others say we've actually not realized the potential of the country. And so maybe we should be doing the work to get us to that place, which will require, an engagement with the idea, the identity, our history, and sort of meditate on what does it mean to belong in this country. So it tries to take big ideas, democracy, affirmative action, police brutality, racism. And instead of talking about structural racism or the need for criminal justice reform, I wanted to talk about the experience of people in this system, the experience of Americans, white, Black, all races, ethnicities. All of us are living in the same system that's underperforming what it could be.
One of the interesting things you do, though, in the book is you kind of compare the experience of understanding your Americanness. And you compare that in your experience with being a person of faith. And then you kind of draw that as an analogy to how we kind of fall in and out of love, if I can put it that way, with the democratic experiment, with the American idea. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, and so you're absolutely right. The first essay, the lead essay, is essentially Ted Johnson's sermon on democracy as delivered by this Black boy from North Carolina who grew up going to church 3 or 4 times a week. And so it's almost like this is my conversion story for why I believe democracy is the way forward in America. And the reason that's important is because democracy's legitimacy as a system writ large is an article of faith on every person who participates in that democracy. If you don't believe that the outcomes of the democracy are legitimate, it results in catastrophe. We don't have to guess at this. We were all around for January 6th. We saw what happened when the legitimacy of institutions and processes are questioned. People die, systems get overturned or unraveled. And so we have to believe the system is worth investing in if we're going to commit to the work of making it more inclusive and to the work of reforming it. If you don't believe that democracy is the answer, it's very hard to get people to invest in voting, to invest